Our first speaker, continuing with the CARS theme, is Professor Calvin Alexander. For nearly 30 years, Calvin has been on the faculty of the Department of Earth Sciences, as it's now called, at the University of Minnesota, Minneapolis campus. His research interests are in karst hydrology, coming from his years of spelunking in his younger days, as well as the whole range of non-Darcyan phenomena, from preferential flow in soils to flow in fractured and granular media. He has done extensive field work in the karst spring sheds of southeastern Minnesota, as well as in the Edwards Aquifer in Texas. And he's been a frequent contributor, and we've all enjoyed his talks. So I might add that he is a nationally renowned karst researcher and has organized several national conferences on karst research that I've gone to and really have been impressed. Today, Calvin will speak to us in a philosophic way, I suppose, on the impact of karst on agriculture.
I hope you're all full of good lunch and you can lean back and just go to sleep and not snore too loudly as we're going through this. If I start snoring, do something. One of the joys and pleasures of being a university professor is you get to work with very bright graduate students. And the last time I taught my karst and tracers class, a young man in the class named Mike Talbot wrote a term paper. And I have been working for Kelton, you were generous, it's almost 40 years now, on the karst, and much of it has focused on the impact of agriculture on karst hydrology and so forth. And Mike turned in a paper entitled The Impact of Karst on Agriculture rather than the other way around. And often just looking at things in a from a different direction leads to some interesting thoughts, and that's what I want to share with you today. So the question I'm trying to ask is, what kind of fundamental constraints does karst hydrogeology put on the practice of agriculture? And this is a big issue. Is that going to go? All right. I want to give you a brief outline here. Introduction. We'll talk about karst impact on modern cropping practices, karst impacts on water resources, and karst impact on soil, and we'll come to some conclusions. Agriculture, it's a huge business. It is a major part of the economy of this state. I like to eat, you like to eat. All of this depends ultimately on agriculture. Agriculture is actually a fairly conceptually simple thing. You can write an equation. Soil plus water plus carbon dioxide plus sunlight gives you carbohydrates plus oxygen. We also like to breathe, and so that's important to us. And this CH2O is a shorthand for a whole range of reduced carbon forms that plants and then animals eat the plants. I originally wrote that down as food, and someone pointed out that a major part of the corn crop is now going to produce ethanol, but it's energy. It's trapped energy, and that's what we use. Farmers are basically in the business of harvesting solar energy. In Minnesota, they use devices, corn and soybean plants, that only work four months of the year. The rest of the time, it's bare dirt. Those of you who drove into this meeting from outstate or from anywhere outside the metro area probably drove through farmland. And that farmland right now is bare dirt if it isn't corn and soybeans. And it's going to remain bare dirt until late May or sometime in June, depending on what Mother Nature has in store for us for the rest of this spring. That is a very fundamental limit on what we're doing. Just to give you an idea of the scale, this is a map showing the cropland in the United States. We are, of course, sitting right in there somewhere now. This is part of the largest piece of arable farm land on the surface of this planet. It is an incredible resource, both to our country and to Canada and to the world. We used to export a whole lot more food than we do in the last few years because, again, we have chosen to convert a major part of that corn into ethanol for fuel purposes. That sits on top of a karst landscape. And that karst landscape is all of southeastern Minnesota, southwestern Wisconsin, wraps around southern Wisconsin, northeastern Iowa, northwestern Illinois. And that puts, again, fundamental constraints on how you can do agriculture. I often have dealt over the years with this question of what is a karst, and a simple, effective definition is if you have limestone beneath your feet and less than 50 feet of soil cover on top of it, you're standing on a karst. And this is what this map, this is just across the colored areas here are the areas underlain by limestone. The green and yellow areas are covered by 50 to 100 and 100 plus feet of glacial drift. So the areas in red are the areas of active karst. And that includes the counties in southeastern Minnesota, but it also includes the metro area as well. Okay, soil plus water plus carbon dioxide equals sunlight plus to give you carbohydrates and oxygen. What does karst do to this equation? How does being on top of a karst aquifer in a karst landscape change this equation in a practical fashion? In the American mode, I am going to use an utterly indefensible combination of metric and SI units. For the more rational members of the audience, I offer the following conversions. A square mile is a section, is 640 acres, is about 256 hectares. A quarter of a square mile, a quarter, 40 acres and a mule, for those of you who have long histories, is equal to about 16 hectares. Okay. One of the new tools, and a couple of people have, Tony mentioned this, and Jeff also mentioned this, thanks to a giant storm that we had in 2007 in southeastern Minnesota, the state of Minnesota purchased high-resolution LIDAR for the seven counties, I think it is, in southeastern Minnesota. And I'm going to base much of my talk on these maps. And this is an example of one. This is a quarter section, a half a mile on the square. This one happens to be in central Fillmore County. This resource was flown in October of 2008. Remember, LIDAR has the ability to look through leaves, and they deliberately picked the fall anyway. So this is the first time we've been able to synoptically look at all of the landscape in southeastern Minnesota without worrying about those sorts of things. Seven counties, the resolution is about north, south, east, west, about 1 meter, and the vertical resolution is about 25 centimeters on this data. What I'm going to be showing you are shaded relief digital elevation models of this. This one and then the subsequent ones, the sun angle is assumed to be, or for the computer assumes the sun is about 45 degrees above the horizon, and it's coming in from the northwest. Now, that doesn't happen very often in Minnesota, but it's a nice way to look at it. Okay. Karst impact on modern farming first. This is big. Mechanized modern farming. What do you like for that? It is optimized for broad expanses of relatively flat lands. If you're going to invest $500,000 in this kind of equipment, you want big flat land that you can run across it. Hundreds of meters to kilometers are what you would like to run. Okay? 40 acres and a mule is out a long time ago. Karst topography is spectacularly not flat. It's a little hard to run a combine over tower karst in China. It's some of the most beautiful landscapes in the world, but it's not very conducive to modern agriculture. Now let's go back to the one I just showed you. This is a much smaller scale. This is only a half mile in size, but that's covered with sinkholes. You can farm around them and up and down and so forth about them, but it's difficult, and you can't do it anywhere near as rapidly and as with low energy as you would like to. In addition to the very obvious sinkholes that are all over this landscape, notice that there are a bunch of closed depressions here that are being farmed across. These are buried sinkholes, sinkholes that have been temporarily clogged up. You can see drainages coming down the roads and emptying into that you can see all kinds of things here, and we'll keep looking at these as we go through. Okay. Not only is karst surfaces not flat, they are dynamic. Dynamic landscapes complicate farming. If you walk out in your bean field this spring and part of it's not there anymore, this is not a good thing. This complicates your life. Luckily, most of the landscape is farmland, and so this doesn't hurt anything except perhaps some earthworms and gophers or something. But sometimes those sinkholes open under tractors. Now, this is not a good idea. This can, you know, ruin your whole day. Karst adds another risk factor to agriculture, which is already the biggest gambling joint in human society. Ask any farmer, will tell you that. Okay. On water, let's talk about water resources now. Karst are surfaces and aquifers are characterized by very, very rapid interconnections between surface and groundwater. And what this does is it greatly exacerbates your ability to manage to have the right amount of water in the soil at the right time when you need to grow crops. And this is particularly obvious in areas which have strong seasonal precipitation, monsoonal sort of situations in many parts of the world. In the wet periods, karst systems are very prone to flooding, sometimes from below. Those of you who have driven in southeastern Minnesota have probably seen the big quarry that sits just northwest of Fountain, Minnesota, which is a big active limestone quarry. It has a major karst conduit under it, and when it gets a big rain in the surrounding area, this is one of the ones that Tony was showing you this morning, that a quarry floods from below. The water comes up out of the conduits and floods the quarry, and you walk out, the guys show up the next morning to work, and their bulldozers and crushers are under 20 feet of water. This is nothing to make them happy. In dry periods, the surface water can be essentially absent for months at a time. 6-8 months, there's just basically no surface water there. Okay, let me show you an example of this. This is data from a data logger that was monitoring the temperature, conductivity, and water level in a cave stream in central Fillmore County. This is a little over a year's data from March of 2008 to March of 2009. What you see here, let's look at these first. The red line is the temperature. This starts in March, and so the average temperature is somewhere around 8.9 degrees or something like that, but it doesn't spend much time on the average. In the spring, you have snowmelt coming in pulses, and so you can see the individual cold water pulses coming into this system. As it rises in the spring, the rain gets warmer and the groundwater temperature comes up. And then in June, on June 7th and 8th, we got a gigantic storm. This is of 2008. Dumped about 13 inches of rainfall in less than 24 hours on this area. The water level in the temperature spiked because it was a warm rain. The water level rose 37 feet, and I'll show you in a minute. But it dropped out in just a day and a half, and then it was back down, and that temperature remained constant. Well, it's actually slowly declining. It's hard to see at this scale. Until all the way till the next February of 2009 when we started getting snow melt, and you see the pattern beginning to repeat. But absolutely nothing was happening here. There was no water on the landscape at that time, but there had been a huge amount of water on the landscape there. Conductivity in the green, the water that runs in from the surface has much lower total dissolved solids, and so it's a conductivity. It goes down when these storm pulses come in, and that's what you see. Then it just kind of bounces around, and then it goes down again when you get to the next year's spring snowmelt. The water level is the blue line. It spikes up with the events. It enormously spiked up with that one, and then it just kind of leveled off and settled down until you begin to get spikes the next spring. Now I want to go forward. One of my friends happened to be driving through this area on June the 7th. The big rain was the night of the 7th and 8th, And this is what it looked like in the early afternoon of the June 7th of 2008, just driving down the road. He was pouring rain, so forgive the water drops on the windshield and so forth. Again, this is the 7th of June. That is bare dirt, okay? The water is sheeting off of that dirt, carrying erosion. Notice that the road ditch is not bare dirt. The road ditch has already got grass that's a foot high. You can see a fence line running out through here that's got grass on it. You can see this fence line, which is being breached here, and this is a sinkhole, and all of this sediment is just washing into there. An enormous amount of sediment. Nobody knows how much. Nobody knows how to measure this kind of a situation poured off of that field in one rain event. And then it really rained. So this is the blow-up of that event on the 7th and 8th of June. The water level, and this device is at the bottom of a 30-inch shaft that's about 80 feet deep. You're standing in a cave passage with a stream running along your feet. The water level rose 37 feet. The cave passage is 8 feet high. That would not have been a good place to be at that point. We know how high the pressure transducer overranged, but we know how high it was because there was a bathtub ring of debris in the entrance shaft at 37 feet above the floor. It was a warm rain, and so in June, so the temperature spikes are up. There's still a dilution event, so the conductivities go down. Okay, let me talk about a societal logic area here. Karst sinkholes or dolines are sufficient evidence that a karst aquifer is present. But sinkholes are not necessary evidence that a karst aquifer is present. Lots and lots, most karst aquifers aren't covered with sinkholes for a variety of reasons. The absence of a sinkhole on a particular piece of property is not evidence, much less proof, that this is not a karst aquifer under your feet. This is what lawyers for people who want to build landfills or confined animal feedlots would like to argue, that if I'm more than 27 inches from the nearest sinkhole, I'm not on a karst. That's over there, and it just doesn't work that way. Okay. Large sinkholes are end members of a continuum that extends down to millimeter macropores. There's just a complete range of sizes, all of which can take an awful lot of water into the subsurface. New sinkholes routinely form. Our best estimate is the rate of sinkhole formation in southeastern Minnesota is something like 5 to 10% of the number of sinkholes that you can see on the surface at any time. Because old sinkholes get closed all the time. In Minnesota, these processes include natural processes of glacial activity, wind, and running water, and so forth, and bulldozers and front-end loaders and dump trucks. If you are a farmer and you have a sinkhole open in your field, or a household owner and one opens in your yard, you want it to go away. You fill it up. It's dangerous. Somebody might fall into it, or the government might make you do something about it. Let me show you some examples of this. This is an area right down on the Iowa-Minnesota state line. This is in Fillmore County. This is the little community of Bristol. For those of you who know this area, Harmony is just off here. Spring Valley's up over there. These are square miles that you can see here. This is the upper Iowa River is coming along here. It meanders up into Minnesota and comes out. There's some big springs here. This is a big blind valley over here. It is 11 miles straight line from here to here. We've run dye traces. It takes about 4 days for the water to go that far. The dye we put in there also comes out of a spring down here, and it also hit a farmer's house right there. We've done dye traces from up here. They come down to Odessa Spring. Niagara Cave, a commercial cave, is right here, and its water feeds to these two. I want to focus on a little area right here just south of Bristol. This is the picture. There's that corner right there. This is an air photo taken in June of 2003. And what you can see is the fracture pattern in the underlying rock, because this was a dry area and the soil had dried out and the cracks had a little more water in them. You can see the drainage where much of the soil that has eroded off of this has just dropped in these first order drainage ditches here. So there's much less topsoil here and a lot more topsoil there, but the topsoil here doesn't do them any good for farming in here. But this takes special conditions to see. If you look at it in another air photo, you can't see much of anything except this depression had a little bit of water standing in it at that point. But when it dries out, they farm right across it. Let's look at this in LIDAR. So here's the LIDAR map of the same area. You can't see the joints, but you can see the lines of depressions if you ask this farmer, he will tell you that there's no sinkholes on his property. But there are clearly closed depressions there. You can see them. They're aligned and everything. Okay. Now, I want to move from up here over here, just about a little over a mile away to the southeast. Here's that same 2003 photo. This is a 40-acre plot here, and you see there's no sinkholes there. All right? If you look in 2003, there's still no sinkholes. Now, this is a tree. In this case, the sun was up here somewhere. This is a photo that's casting a shadow. Here's the same tree. Remember that tree, because I'm going to show you something at the X next. In that June 2008 storm, 13 inches of water came down that grass waterway, and it punched a new sinkhole. This is the tree right here. So this is at the base of the tree. That sinkhole was 27 meters long and 14 meters wide. It was about 6 meters between the bedrock surface the young man is standing on and the former ground surface. You could see a black A horizon up here. There was then 4 or 5 meters of imbricated limestone colluvium over colluvium, and there were ostrander polished pebbles right on top of the bedrock. And right behind him, there was a 60-foot deep hole in the bedrock that opened into a cave. Now, this is the LIDAR image. This was taken in October of 2008, a few months after the sinkhole opened. And so now you are looking at that sinkhole right there. The tree you don't see because the LIDAR doesn't see the tree. This is the temporary driveway that had been created by myself and other people driving out there to start exploring what was in that hole. What was in that hole turned out to be, to date, about 3.6 miles of cave. The original entrance was right here. All of this cave was there. The road comes right down through here. This was under a 40 acres that until June of 2008 had no sinkholes and therefore wasn't a karst. Okay? This is not trivial holes. This is the Maquoketa and the top of the Dubuque. A couple of my caver friends are wandering along. Here's another room. Then you get to the really big rooms and so forth. You get interesting, huh? Pardon? No, that's all rock. That is black dirt that has been washed into the hole. Yes, yes. And this thing also floods. Basically to the ceiling. Have you ever wondered what a sinkhole looks like from the bottom? That's the collapse cone in crossing a cave passage. It's just kind of the mirror image of the hole on top. Karst impact on water resources. Water storage dams. The solution that the human race figured out 10,000 years ago was if all the water runs out in a few months, build a dam and trap the water. And this set up water civilizations, hydraulic civilizations they're called, because you had to have organizations to build and maintain dams and canals and so forth. So we've been at this for a long time. The Code of Hammurabi, the first written record we have of laws in the world, was about half water law. So in southeastern Minnesota and elsewhere, we build dams. And Mother Nature says, thank you, and punches a hole behind them. This happens all the time. If you drive around karst areas, you will see an amazing number of holes of pond dams that don't have any water behind them. This also opens under sewage lagoons and other kinds of waste storage devices. It's a major problem. Big dams, it happens all the time. If they're not there, it will punch holes under and around the dam on a time scale of decades. Karst has a profound impact on nutrient resources because they wash through so quickly. This is wasted resources. Farmers aren't buying nitrogen and herbicides and pesticides to lose them. They're trying to grow crops with them, but they lose them through very quickly. This is a diagram that was put together by Justin Watkins at the Rochester MPCA, and I don't think Justin's here today, but if he is, thank you anyway. This is a correlation between the nitrate-nitrogen levels in the base flow of surface streams draining off of various sized karst basins. And it's a beautiful correlation. This is the percent of those individual basins that is in row crop agriculture, corn plus soybeans, and this is the nitrate-nitrogen content of the base flow. Notice that this correlation line goes almost through zero. Not only is the amount of nitrate correlated with the row crop agriculture, if the row crop agriculture wasn't there, there wouldn't be any nitrate at all in the groundwater. And there's a nice poster from the Winona State Group over there talking about their lysimeter data, and they find the same thing. And the correlation holds very well. By the time you get out to about 50 or 60% of your basin in row crop agriculture, the runoff water at base level, base flow, is going to be above the drinking water standard for nitrate nitrogen at 10 parts per million. This is not new. Iowa has similar relations. Nebraska has similar relations. These are all published data. There's no Goldilocks zone in the water resources in a karst regime. You either go from having too much water to having too little water, and you can go between those extremes in a few days. It just doesn't last very long. Very little time is spent just in the right amount. All of the above notwithstanding, karst aquifers are some of the most productive and important aquifers and supply a major fraction of humanity's water supply. Karst springs have provided critical water resources to our species for as long as it has existed. Finally, karst, the impact on the soils themselves. Karst carbonates typically have little residual solids when they are weathered, and so their weathering produces very little soil. The soils in karst landscapes are typically thin and very fragile. The barren limestone hills of Europe and Asia were verdant forests before agriculture began in those areas. In Minnesota karst lands, the soils are mostly material that has been transported to where it is today by glacial processes, either tills or outwash sands or lusts. All of those are glacial processes. I wanted to throw in one picture. This is in Bosnia, which is where the word karst was invented. 400 years ago, this was a verdant forest of oak trees. They cut them all down, and the soil disappeared, and now all you have left is the bare rock. The only agricultural soils that are available is in the bottom of this sinkhole. I gave this talk last summer at a meeting in Montana, and a fellow from Bosnia was there, and he says, I know where that picture is. Do you know that that's now a minefield and you can't walk on it? That's another whole issue. Okay, I've shown you a bunch of pictures of LIDAR of karst of southeastern Minnesota. And you can see sinkholes, you can see buried sinkholes, you can see new sinkholes on the surface, you can see all sorts of things about the landscape. You can see the roads and so forth. They've deliberately taken the buildings out, and Kelton's coming up here. What else can you see? You can see the fence rows. Why can you see a fence row in a LIDAR image? fence posts are this big around. The wire doesn't show up. You can see them because those fences are sitting on top of ridges. And as in my picture of the June storm, those ridges have grass and weeds growing on them, and so they don't erode away as fast as the adjacent soils. So the height of those ridges is a lower limit on the total amount of erosion that has occurred off that soil. These are very prone to this sort of thing. Since European settlers have converted this land to agriculture, in many cases we have lost a meter or more of topsoil. This is not a sustainable situation. This is a picture from China. 20 years ago, this was dense forest. They cleared the forest to start farming, and the soil has disappeared. They have a name for it, rocky desertification. It just disappears. Okay, agriculture, simple equation. Karst has major impacts. The topography is highly irregular at the field scales. It's a dynamic. The water resources has both flood and drought conditions. The soil is thin, patchy, and fragile. Agriculture can lead to extremely rapid soil losses. Karst agriculture is possible, but unless it is done very carefully, it is not sustainable. Large-scale machine and input intensive modern agriculture can quickly destroy the soils. Quote from Wendell Berry, nature will take care of this, and we won't like the answer. Thank you.
We're a little over, so maybe just one question.